jurors are treated to testimony ranging from the comical to the surreal regarding the collection of evidence in the ongoing murder trial of Karen Reed. Plus, trial is underway for a New Jersey father accused of forcing his 6-year-old son to endure running on a treadmill to the point of complete exhaustion, which prosecutors allege ultimately led to the boy's murder. And Chad Dorman, accused of executing his 3 young sons, fights the death penalty by now claiming he was insane. All this and much more this week on Courtroom Confidential. I'm your host, Joshua Ritter, a former Los Angeles prosecutor turned criminal defense attorney with over 15 years' experience navigating the criminal justice system, bringing you my unique insights from both sides of the courtroom. Join us every Friday as we dive into headline-making cases from across the country. All right, let's jump right in. First, Boston woman Karen Reed's high-profile murder trial continued to grab headlines this week. Reed faces charges in connection with the 2022 death of her boyfriend, police officer John O'Keefe. Monday's testimony jumped off with the surreal description of unorthodox methods investigators used to gather evidence, including the use of red plastic Solo cups from a neighbor to collect samples of blood. They then brought those samples back to the Canton Police Station in a stop-and-shop paper bag. Investigators explained that they didn't have anything else to collect the evidence and that they were left to improvise. The bizarre testimony continued with a description of how a snowblower was used to clear the crime scene, with one investigator concluding that nothing about the scene was standard. Sergeant Michael Lank testified on Tuesday about finding a broken cocktail glass and a piece of red plastic in the snow. Prosecutors looked to be developing an argument that O'Keefe was holding the glass when he was hit by Reed's SUV. On Wednesday, jurors were shown surveillance video from inside 2 Canton bars showing O'Keefe and friends, plus Reed, who is seen on the video, greeting O'Keefe with a hug and a kiss. Witnesses included a bartender and several friends who joined the group at the bars, testifying that they saw no trouble between Reed and O'Keefe. Prosecutors have maintained that the couple fought that night. All right, well, what's going on here? First of all, this case has become about who is the villain. And I've talked about this before. I am a former law partner of Alan Jackson. I was a former law clerk of his. I've known him way going back to his time in the DA's office and my time in the DA's office when he prosecuted Phil Spector for murder. I've known him for a very long time. And one thing he has always said is that it is not enough in a criminal defense case. It is not enough to say that your client is not the bad guy. You have to give them a bad guy. You have to provide that to the jurors. You can't just say, my client didn't do it. You have to also say who did do it. And they have done a masterful job, both AJ and David Iannetti in this case, in presenting to the jurors who that bad guy is, who that villain is. That villain is the police department itself. They were, at best, sloppy and unprepared. As the evidence is unfolding real time for us right now, that is the way it's coming out, even through the prosecution testimony, that at best, they were sloppy and unprepared to investigate this type of a case. And at worst, they were untrustworthy and possibly even involved in some sort of conspiracy or cover-up. Now, I don't know if the evidence has gone as far as proving that at this point, but when the defense gets up to argue at the end of this case and they stand up to make that argument that this is a conspiracy, this is a cover-up, they've already said that in opening statements. Essentially, they're going to say that in closing arguments, that when they stand up to say that, they will have some credibility behind the arguments that they're making based upon just the sloppiness and the lack of preparation. And quite frankly, just seeing overwhelmed and underskilled to be handling this type of a murder investigation, they will be able to make those arguments with a straight face. Will they win the day? Time will tell. We will see. But that is something that they can stand there, I think, with a straight face and make that argument to the jurors based on what I have seen so far in this trial. Now, what are prosecutors going to do about it? How are they going to flip this narrative? Well, I think first they're going to need to talk about how, listen, this was an extreme circumstance. There were exigent circumstances and concerns here. They had a crime scene that happened to be in a snowstorm, and they needed to do something about that. And they didn't have the ability to collect evidence at their leisure. They didn't have the ability to collect that evidence in even a proper way. And they did the best that they could. Now, does that end up making them look a little ridiculous? Or should we applaud them for having some ingenuity to finding some plastic cups that are apparently sanitary, having been taken out of a new plastic bag themselves? Do they put that in some sort of a bag that they can transport it back to the station? Yes. Was it perfect? No. Does that mean that none of the evidence can be relied upon? And there's the question. Is it bad enough that jurors should just throw out the collection of all of that altogether because they cannot be trusted, the trustworthiness of it? But I think an even stronger argument for the prosecution is kind of the so what argument. Yeah, this was awful. Yeah, this was embarrassing. Yeah, in hindsight, they should have handled this all differently. But whether or not they gathered certain blood in a plastic cup or in an evidence bag or however else they should have done it, that doesn't change the fact that the man's dead where he lies, that there's a broken glass there that indicates that he likely was holding it at the time that the car impacted him or whatever impacted him, and not, therefore, more importantly, that he was beaten inside. Now, I know people are going to go after me and say that doesn't prove anything. They could have planted the glass and everything else. Yes, absolutely. But I'm saying from the prosecution's perspective, how can they flip this narrative to explain how the collection of this really doesn't matter? It's what was there. Does the collection have to go to the reliability of what was found? Absolutely. But still, and I've dealt with this myself. Not every case is perfect as a prosecution. Not every case did the police do everything right. And sometimes you just have to get through all of that fog presented by the defense and say, it doesn't really matter, folks. What matters, folks, is that she said, I hit him out of her own mouth. What matters is that she has a broken taillight. What matters is whether or not that can be linked to evidence found around the victim's body. Again, time will tell if all of those things can be proven true, but those are the things that the prosecution should be highlighting on. But what do you guys think? I know that every time we talk about this case, we got a lot of people who have been following it very closely, pointing out everything I got wrong. Bring it on. Let it rain. I want to hear all about it. But my question really is, has the damage been done to the prosecution's case so far, or can they recover from this? What do you think? Please let us know in the comments. All right, moving on. New Jersey father Christopher Greger is on trial for endangering the welfare of a child and murder in connection to the 2021 death of his six-year-old son. On Tuesday, jurors heard emotionally charged testimony of the final minutes of Corey Macholo's life from one of the nurses who tried to save him. According to nurse Lindsay Carnevale, Greger showed no signs of emotion upon bringing Corey to the hospital, and minutes before the boy died, Greger left the room and never returned. Carnevale acknowledged under cross-examination that she was a member of Justice for Corey, a Facebook page set up by Corey's mother. Sergeant Raymond Coles also testified Tuesday that an hour after Corey died, Greger searched, quote, "Can your phone be traced in airplane mode?" and "Can my car be tracked?" adding that 2 days after Corey died, Greger searched, "There was a murder determination from an autopsy. How long to file charges?" Rounding out the day was a state Child Protective Services employee who testified that Greger called the state's child abuse hotline the morning that Corey died. During the call, Greger claimed that the boy had been told by his mother to lie to doctors and claim that Greger hit him. If convicted of the murder charge, Greger faces 30 years to life in prison. All right, well, what's happening here? The evidence in this case is incredibly strong, but it is not the evidence that you're thinking about. We have all seen the video in this case of that young boy running as hard as he possibly can while his father stands there. And then as the boy begins to collapse from exhaustion, picks him up and places him back down on that treadmill to make him run again. It is difficult to watch. We are not going to show that video here. We will provide you with a link if you want to check it out, but I'm sure you've seen it already if you've been following this case. And I will tell you, I have watched it a few times, and every single time I do, it is hard for me not to get choked up to think about what this young man was going through. And the part that's so heartbreaking is that he is just trying to please his father. I think he's afraid of him. I think he's terrified of the abuse, but I think he's also just trying to please the man. Here's a man who, in this boy's entire world, the only person who is supposed to be protecting him is the man who's torturing him. And make no mistake, that is what we are watching. That is what we are witnessing, is the torture of this young man. But again, this case comes down to murder, and that murder did not take place that day. And in fact, the prosecution is not even alleging that the running on that treadmill is exactly what led to the murder, but that the murder took place because of this systematic abuse days later. And that's why I say that the most important and damaging evidence as far as the murder goes is not that video. It's what we just heard about with these consciousness of guilt type evidence. It's these searches for, can your phone be traced in airplane mode? Can my car be tracked? If there was a murder determination, how long to file charges? That is the stuff that's going to nail him to the wall as far as guilt for murder. That is the consciousness of a person who has just committed a murder and knows it. Someone calling up protective services and already trying to establish a defense by saying, the boy was told to lie and that I hit him. He knows he took this young, innocent man's life, his own son, and he's trying to figure out a way to cover it all up and to cover his own tracks. That is what the jurors are going to convict him for. The videotape is going to just make them sleep well about it. The videotape is about the abuse and the systematic abuse, and how could a man take his own son's life. And to get those jurors' heads wrapped around that, that's what that video is important for. But the important evidence as far as linking this man to murder are the things that come out of his own mouth and his own doing through these Google searches. But you guys tell me what you think. Was this case over the second that jurors saw that video? I think yes. You tell me. Let us know in the comments. Always curious to hear your thoughts. All right, attorneys for Chad Dorman, the Ohio man accused of shooting his three young sons to death in 2023, have filed a motion asking that the death penalty be dropped from consideration, citing serious mental illness at the time of the offense. Dorman's jury trial date has now been vacated to hear the motion, with the hearing scheduled for August, meaning a trial will not be likely to happen this year. According to the Ohio Constitution, people proven to have suffered from a serious mental illness at the time they committed a crime cannot be executed by the state. Dorman faces 21 separate charges tied to the allegations that he shot and killed 4-year-old Hunter, 7-year-old Clayton, and 3-year-old Chase, execution style, on June 15th, 2023. All right, well, what's happening here? Again, another case that absolutely rips at my heart to think about what was going through these young boys' lives in those final moments. But this case has already suffered setbacks, you may remember. You remember that Dorman initially made a statement to police where he essentially confessed to these murders, and that was subsequently thrown out for Miranda violations. It's frustrating and fascinating, and it makes you understand how important the work of law enforcement officers are, not just to get the bad guy, but make sure that you're doing everything right along the way. And now we're confronted with this argument about his sanity and whether or not he should be eligible for the death penalty. I think that if you tell any good-hearted person what took place in this case, and if there is not some sort of moral reason that they would object to capital punishment, they would say that this is exactly the type of case that capital punishment is reserved for. This is evil. This is the worst of the worst. But does this argument that his attorneys are making have legs? Is there any merit to it? And the answer is unfortunately yes. We have decided as a country through our Constitution and the Eighth Amendment against cruel and unusual punishment. And Ohio also has in their Constitution a prevention against cruel and unusual punishment that they have decided extends towards those who are suffering from mental illness and whether or not they are eligible for the death penalty. And if you think about it, the question isn't so much should we, but do we even want to be executing people who are suffering from mental illness or a psychotic break at the time that they commit a crime? And I will say, I don't think the answer is so clear cut. I don't think that we should open up the door for just anyone who commits an act of atrocity like this to say, hey, I was crazy. I was crazy at the time. And even if you find me guilty, the worst that you can do to me is throwing me in prison for the rest of my life. But I shouldn't be eligible for the death penalty. I don't think it should be an excuse for anything and everything. Because I think also, by the way, I think you can be suffering from mental illness and still be held responsible to the full extent of the law for your actions. But also, do we really want to get into the business of executing people? The greatest punishment we have in this country, who are people that are absolutely out of their minds and delusional and suffering from some sort of mental illness. And that doesn't mean that they go free. That's not what we're talking about here. They're not arguing. They are making an argument later on at trial that he should be not guilty by reason of insanity. But this argument is separate and apart from that, saying that even if we get to trial, before we get to trial, the death penalty should be taken off the table. And I will be honest with you, this argument may have a chance. So prepare yourselves for that. We may be looking at a case where a man who commits this type of crime may not even be facing the death penalty. But one last point I'll make on this is that if the prosecution decides, or if the judge decides to take the death penalty off the table, that may preclude some of this mental health stuff from playing a role in the guilt phase of his trial. Because when you have a NGI, not guilty by reason of insanity, defense, that is usually in what's called a bifurcated trial. So they have the guilt phase, deciding, did this person commit this or not? And then they have a phase dealing with his mental health. And I'm wondering if there might be some advantage with taking death penalty off the table if they can't then have an argument to somehow squeeze that into the guilt phase and argue his mental phase in guilt because the death penalty is on the table. I don't know if I'm getting too much into the weeds on all of this, but end of the day, this case is sickening, and I am very troubled by how things have been going on this case so far. I think because I'm just so troubled by what took place to begin with and to think about the final moments of those young men. But again, let me know your thoughts. We talked about this a little bit earlier in the week, and you guys had some very strong thoughts about it. And so I'd like to hear from you now. Let me know in the comments. Also making headlines this week, a forensic pathologist spoke in graphic detail about the autopsies of Joshua J.J. Vallow and Tylee Ryan during his testimony Wednesday in the Chad Daybell triple murder trial. Jurors learned that 7-year-old J.J. was suffocated by duct tape and bags that had been placed on his head. The photos, not displayed to members of the public, showed duct tape around his ankles, binding his hands and arms together and covering his mouth. His injuries also included scratch-like abrasions on his neck, indicating that he may have been desperately struggling to get the bag off of his head before he suffocated to death. The cases this week are absolutely killing me, I gotta tell you folks. During this troubling testimony, multiple jurors were seen crying and wiping their eyes. That's not shocking at all. A forensic scientist testified to latent prints discovered on the plastic bag used to encase JJ's body. Those prints were matched to Alex Cox, Lori Vallow's brother. Trial continues for popular TikTok creator Ali Abulaban, who is charged in the October 2021 shooting deaths of his wife, Anna Abulaban, and her friend, Rayburn Barron, at a San Diego luxury apartment complex. On Tuesday, jurors listened to the audio of the 911 call Abulaban made to report that his wife and another man were dead, along with responding officers' body cam videos of the moment they entered the apartment and found the two victims dead. Several neighbors also testified Tuesday, recalling multiple previous occasions hearing commotion or yelling coming from the couple's apartment. Abulaban is expected to testify in this case, and if he does, we plan on making a video reacting live to exactly that. The doctor who drove his Tesla off of a 250-foot cliff with his wife and two children inside is seeking a mental health diversion in his case. If granted, he would be released from jail and put on a two-year treatment plan. While experts from both the prosecution and defense testified that Dharmesh Patel was experiencing some form of psychotic episode at the time of the 2023 incident, leading him to believe that his two children may have been sex trafficked, prosecutors believe the case should remain in criminal court. To the surprise of many followers of the case, Patel's wife also made an impassioned plea to the court to spare him prison time and consider mental health treatment. A ruling on the motion has yet to be determined. Colorado dentist James Craig, accused of killing his wife by poisoning her protein shakes, allegedly asked a fellow inmate to plant evidence in exchange for free dental work. According to the prosecution, Craig asked a fellow inmate to place letters in his garage and trunk at his home. The letters were allegedly meant to appear as if his wife had written them. The letters were purported to convey that Craig's wife was suicidal after learning about her husband's affair. The next court appearance for Craig is set for June 5th. In an emotionally charged hearing where family members made tearful pleas to the court for the maximum penalty, Adam Montgomery, the New Hampshire man convicted of killing his 5-year-old daughter, was sentenced on Thursday to 45 years to life in prison. Last month, the judge ruled that Montgomery must appear in person for his sentencing after he refused to attend his own trial. Before we get to what's on the docket for next week, I wanted to take this time to thank you all for your support. It has truly been touching. The love from our growing community has been overwhelming. If you haven't already, please subscribe. Please make sure to like this episode and leave a comment. We always highly appreciate your feedback. Finally, on the docket for next week, Corey Richens, the Utah mother of three who's accused of killing her husband, is set to appear in court Wednesday, May 15th for a preliminary hearing. The community first heard of Richens in April of 2023 when she was promoting her children's book on grieving after her husband Eric died unexpectedly in March of 2022. Prosecutors now claim that Corey in fact poisoned her husband with 5 times the lethal dose of fentanyl. Her motive was allegedly to inherit his estate and benefit from life insurance policies she took out on him without his knowledge. The coming hearing will determine if the case proceeds to trial. All right, that's it for this week. I'm your host, Joshua Ritter. You can find me on social media at Joshua Ritter ESQ or at joshuaritter.com. Thank you again for joining me. Have a great weekend, and I'll see you again next week on Courtroom Confidential.